Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Here's what's coming up on this weekend edition. The transition of power in the U.S. not going as smoothly as maybe it has in the past. We'll have some details about that. Some insight into how people live to be over 100, if you want to. And we'll look at Syria, as well as what's going on in the Middle East. The ongoing peace process that produces a lot of things, but not peace. That and more this edition, Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here in Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. You can send any emails you have to comments at kpcg.fm. This is the weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Dwight Falk with you here today. Grant Turgeon and Abraham Blondeau, both here. Greetings, gentlemen.
Hello.
It's the rare three-headed beast today.
The beast has returned.
Hasn't been since Monday.
That's right. And it's a special treat. It's a weekend treat. You're welcome. a lot going on, a lot to talk about. The U.S. Has been making some, lots of headlines, right? Yesterday they had sanctions against Russia, expelled, 35 Russians, something
right.
like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that was the payback for these cyber attacks, I guess. And so Zero Hedge has kind of an interesting little write-up about that. I don't remember what their title was, but I made my own title. The Power of Disregard. It has disregarded it. In a statement posted by the Kremlin, they said that Russia won't expel any Americans in retaliation to U.S. moves. In a brutal demonstration of just how irrelevant Obama's 11th-hour decision is for the U.S.-Russian relations. They said the reversal comes as Russian officials portrayed U.S. sanctions as a last act of a lame duck president and suggested that Trump could reverse them when he takes over the White House in January. And Russia, I think it's their official Twitter, a country's Twitter, they put up a picture of a duck, like right. a little duck, a little baby duck. What do they call those things? Duckling.
Duckling.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah. I thought Gosling, but that's a goose. And Ryan Gosling, the actor. But so anyway, yeah, they mocked him and then they just said, we're not going to do anything about it. And it's pretty interesting. They said that, in their Twitter here, they said President Obama expels 35 Russian diplomats in Cold War deja vu, as everybody, including American people, will be glad to see the last of this hapless administration. And then from their full statement posted on the Kremlin website, they say, although we have the right to retaliate, we will not resort to irresponsible kitchen diplomacy, but will plan on further steps to restore Russian-U.S. relations based on the policies of the Trump administration. Zero Hedge says, and with that one statement, Obama lost the diplomatic war with Russia. You agree with that? Think he kind of shot for the big counterattack and Russia just ignored him?
Yeah, I think that if not, I'm not sure if he lost anything, but he's highly embarrassed. And I think it just does show how little one of the most powerful men in the world regards President Obama. I mean, Putin will still be there for probably many years to come. And he just completely ignores the big sanctions and retaliation that President Obama was going to slap on him for interfering in the election. And he says, it doesn't matter. We'll just wait until January 20th. So I think that to other world leaders, and I think President Obama should maybe take this as a little humbling step that if your main rival doesn't listen to you anymore when you're trying to upstage him with sanctions, that probably means that you're on the wrong path.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like if you tell your kid, hey, you did that. Here's the punishment. And they go, I'll just talk to mom about it. You've lost control at that point.
Yeah, and his sanctions in the first place were just a result of what they call catastrophizing over the election and basically blaming all of the darkest forces for what transpired in this election, which made Mr. Trump the president now. And so he's just basically carrying out the liberal tears to the extreme and sanctioning Russia. And it's kind of strange. What world are we living in where the communist radical left is supposedly arch enemies of Russia now?
Yeah, when the news came out yesterday, I don't know, it struck me as not a good decision. Because I'm like, well, do we even know that they did anything? And I think it is good to take a stand against another nation if they're doing something, but we have surrendered to them on every front, and now it kind of seems like a temper tantrum. And I'm like, do you want to poke that bear, though? I mean, over this? There are things that you should stand up against, but over these potentially, no pun intended, trumped up charges. I mean, I haven't seen any proof that they did anything. So have you guys seen anything?
It's just allegations, and I think the FBI said they did. Or CIA, one of the two, said they did. But I've also seen...
I mean, in what fashion? Like
propaganda, maybe?
Just they were able to trace like the people who did it, and some of them live in Russia, like they're hackers.
Who hacked the DNC and released some documents?
Yeah.
I don't even care about that. I mean, if you don't have anything to hide, so what? I mean, not that they should be allowed to hack, but don't nations hack each other all the time? Seems like it always happens.
Aren't they also blaming Russia for fake news? So it's really, they're blaming fake news, but WikiLeaks is not fake news. All those emails from the Democratic Party, those are not fake news at all. And it's just nice to actually have the American people be educated before an election for once and to know what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, you aren't going to get the unfettered truth from the media in this country. So anyway... I don't know. I mean, maybe it's good to take some sort of a stand, but it just seems like the wrong thing to choose at the wrong time and the wrong way to do it. And two, you have to remember, I mean, I'm sure all these leaders remember the recent history. Red line in Syria, all the big talk, didn't do anything. And yeah. Now over some emails, you know, or hacking or something. And what are they trying to insinuate, that the election was rigged? I mean, is that the insinuation? If Hillary Clinton had won, would they still do it? I don't know. Seems strange.
It seems like they're really going all out to protect their party. Like, if you somehow damage the Democratic Party, that's a problem. But if you damage America on the world scene as a whole, they don't seem to care about that at all. They just care about the party more than the country.
It's really strange behavior. But so we'll see. But Russia doesn't seem to care at this moment. Or maybe they do. But I mean, they never tell you what they're going to do. Usually they're always pretty good at keeping it quiet. And then even you look at their history with some of the nations they've dealt with, where they've just poisoned people and leaders, and all of a sudden you're like, what happened to that guy? That's kind of the way they work, so it's a little different sometimes.
Yeah, I think for President Obama to do this, he probably chose the most weak sanction possible. And Putin will readily take that, especially when he's getting everything he wants in any other theater of the world. And just to attach Putin's name to Trump, really, I think that's the goal of it, and to his victory. He's really just ignoring all the places he should be taking a stand against Putin, like you mentioned. Ben said he chooses probably the least important issue with the least important sanctions possible.
Yeah, it just reminds me of some sort of an authority figure, a parent or somebody that just, it's like, well, you know, you better watch out or else. And they're like, oh, come on. You're never going to do anything you never have.
Yeah, it's like threatening a bear with a toothpick.
Unless you're really good with that toothpick.
Yeah, unless you're Chuck Norris.
It kind of reminds me of like a high school graduate who's a week away from the graduation ceremony. And in a lot of public schools, they just allow the high school students to pull whatever the pranks they want to. They're not going to expel seniors, the entire senior class, if they're all pulling pranks. And so it's like Mr. Obama is leaving office now, so he doesn't have to deal with the consequences of sanctioning Russia or completely alienating Israel or whatever else. He's just going all out. A lot of those midnight regulations as well. He knows that he doesn't have to be around to deal with the repercussions for those things.
Yeah, and we've got some information about that too. There is this idea that he's trying to handcuff the next administration. I think it's sort of funny because he took a lot of vacations. I'm like, why not just take a vacation now? Now at the very end, all the work is done.
Work.
Right?
Yeah. Just all go, about the legacy, not about real-life consequences.
Go golfing again or something. This is from the Washington Examiner. Obama unleashes 3,853 regulations, 18 for every law, record 97,110 pages of red tape. So, there's some weekend reading for the listeners, if you'd like to. 97,000 pages to get through there, no problem.
There's the nanny state.
So there's a lot there, and who even knows what's in it? I mean, who's going to even read that stuff? Nancy Pelosi, I guess.
Yeah, sounds like one of my history articles. that's a big problem that's been in the American economy for a long time, and that's overregulation. And that's a big reason why Britain left the EU, is because there were so many regulations, it completely stunted enterprise, growth, competition, to where you had to use certain people... or certain vendors who were complicit with the regulations, and those were people usually tied to foreign countries.
Yeah.
Or not all the time, but usually that was the case. And so if you overregulate the economy, it stunts its growth and just causes all sorts of problems. More bureaucracy, more taxes, more administration fees, and that's just going to make America even more top-heavy than it already is.
Yeah, they say that... Congress passed just 211 laws. Obama's team issued an accompanying 3,852 new federal regulations, some costing billions of dollars, which is no big deal because we're swimming in money or debt, or I can't remember which one it is. The 2016 total was the highest annual number of regulations under Obama. Former President Bush issued more in the wake of 9/11, which I guess you could sort of make a case for because that was a major shift in things. So anyway, 97,110 pages. You guys, Abraham, if you want to read that over the weekend, get back to me. Why don't you guys split it up? We'll do it in thirds.
Too easy if we do it in thirds.
30,000-ish a piece, somewhere there.
I'll read the introduction.
Give us a challenge.
I hope it comes leather-bound because that's quite the set.
Yeah, as long as I don't have to print it off myself.
We would run. Yeah, you'd run out of paper. Boy, 97,110 pages. Who do they pay to write that stuff? And it's always written so... in such a confusing way where you read it and you're like, now what are you saying there?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. That must be a lot of lawyers involved.
Yeah, I think I remember someone saying the U.S. tax code, it just by itself, is about 4 or 5 feet tall if you print out every page and just stack it up on sheets of paper. And I think it's something rivaling this. So, and those are just regulations on top of normal laws. On top of all the other regulations that were before that.
That's why you got to love like TurboTax or one of those where they're just like, they have a nice little picture of a house and they're like, do you want to enter your mortgage information? Yes. It's easy. Hit the next arrow. I can't read all these regulations. I assume somebody did. CNN.com has a list here. 9 last minute Obama moves to stymie Trump's agenda, according to their thinking anyway. Number one, the Russia sanctions. They think that's going to hurt the relationship moving forward, probably true. Number two, the Arctic drilling ban. I don't know if you guys have followed that much, but he's made some regulations there too. I guess no drilling or something to that effect. I didn't read all the info, but...
Yeah, the Arctic has a lot of oil reserves, but in order to drill there, it might cause some pollution, so I think, or cause global warming, so that's why they... I mean, there's more to it than that, but that's the main reason behind the ban.
Number three, the Middle East peace process, which we're going to talk more about, of course, and that's been talked about on the Trump Daily Radio Show today, too, with Stephen Fleury, and that's a huge, huge one. Number four, Obamacare enrollment push, and of course, this is coming from CNN, so they're all excited about these things, and they're like, oh, they got so many enrolled, that now there's like, I forget what they said, like 4 million people enrolled. I'm like, there's 330 million people in the U.S. That's not great. Those aren't great numbers. And they're like, there's 4,000 more than last year. One more time, I will bring up that there are over 330 million people in the U.S. So I don't know why that's... They're hoping that if more people sign up, then it'll be harder to get rid of. But that's still not a lot of people. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the strategy behind it was Obamacare was going to fail at some point, but... I think the point of it was no matter who's in office, they have to create some kind of replacement. So there always will be some form of Medicare there, even if it's not the Affordable Care Act, it will be something.
I have a new one they should replace it with. This should be called Kerry Care. John Kerry's the author of it, where he blames you for the disease. And he says, well, if you would just let the disease inhabit your body, you'd be, you know, we could move on with things here. Quit fighting it.
Exactly. Sounds free, familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does sound familiar. It's his policy just with a lot of things in life. Number five, the new national monuments. I didn't read much about that. He's like named some monuments. Have you guys seen anything about that?
Very little. Just that they've been...
it's like gobbling up land or something in the West, right? Like that was the kind of the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a lot more info on this. I just thought I'd bring him up in passing. Number six, closing National Registry, where they don't want to have, you know, Muslims and other people on this list. Might not be a bad time to have that open.
Yeah.
Who knows? Seven, the Gitmo transfers. Apparently there's a lot going on there. Number eight, pardons and, pardons. So a lot of people have been pardoned, which happens, but how many have there been? There's been quite a few, haven't there?
Oh, yeah. There's been hundreds, thousands.
Yeah. And a lot of times you don't really, you know, it kind of goes under the radar until that person commits some huge crime, and you're like, well, now they were pardoned when? So that's interesting. And then finally, they say number nine here. Again, this is a list of what they say. Last minute, Obama moves to stymie Trump's agenda. Number nine, the farewell address. It says, like past presidents, Obama is expected to deliver a formal farewell address before he leaves office. I thought he did that like 20 times. It seems like every time. Anyway.
What about Rolling Stone? Wasn't that one of them?
Exit interview with every magazine. That could have been completely fabricated. We have no idea. Widely expected to take place in Chicago, they say Obama could use the speech to push back against what he's warned is a tribalistic and isolationist streak. So we'll see what he says.
Just so spiteful. I mean, you're not going to get your way. You're done in office. You've been replaced by the American people, and you're still trying to hold up what the American people want.
It's been interesting, you know. As much as they've talked about, oh, yeah, we all get along, and it's a smooth transition. This has been the messiest one I can remember. Not that I've been around that long, but I never remember one being quite this messy. What do you think, historically? Any precedent?
I think there have been some administrations where there's a lot of bad blood, even between the founding fathers, where they it was much similar to this, actually, between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. It was very similar to this, but it wasn't to the same degree. It was over principle and policies. It wasn't about personal attacks on each other.
Right. And they both wanted the best for the U.S. Maybe they had different visions of how that happened, but I don't think that's the case now.
Yeah, exactly. But I can't remember one where, even if there was animosity or clear difference of opinion, one didn't try to undermine the other when they're transferring power. That's because, as President Obama said himself, that's one of the hallmarks of American democracy, is a peaceful transferring of power. But I've never seen a president do so much to undermine and to ridicule his successor.
Yeah, a lot of times, if you go back and you read certain biographies of some of the past leaders, things come out like, oh, he really didn't like so-and-so. Like John Adams didn't like Benjamin Franklin. But I don't know if that was as known at the time. Maybe it was. But it seems like everybody at least got the job done. And then maybe personally they had a thing. But I don't know that it interfered with the job as much as it does now. And even if it did, well, you didn't have the social media to spread it everywhere. I guess you could print it and ride it from one town to the next on horseback. But word didn't travel quite as fast.
Yeah, that's actually... was writing an article on the American Revolution, and a big reason why the Americans won, besides a bunch of miracles, was they didn't infight. And if they were infighting, usually George Washington put an end to it, or some other person stepped forward with a character to quell it, or people just kept their differences to themselves until the conflict and the crisis was over. And that's the only reason we got through it. The British, on the other hand, let personal conflicts get in the way, and it caused so many strategic errors that they lost when they should have easily won. That's always something to think about, is how just vanity, egos, personal clashes can really cost a country a huge degree, especially when you're talking about the president, the high executive.
Yeah. So interesting. We've got some more we're going to talk about there coming up about some of the things going on in Syria, Middle East, and so forth. Sometimes people live to be over 100. There's actually 100,000 people, a little more than that, that are over 100 years old right now on Earth, which is, I don't know, that's not that many, but still, that's a fair number. Just get them all together.
Yeah.
Take a nap. World's largest nap and most confused conversation.
Put them all in the same town.
Yeah, the 100-year-old town. So, Grant, even you're in your family, your dad's dad, he's, how old is he?
He's 96.
96.
He's pretty close.
Yeah. So for some people, it seems like it'd be good to live to be over 100. And other times, it's like, maybe not. Depends on what your situation is. But they say that Spain is the country with the greatest life expectancy after Japan. And the reason they phrase it that way is the article here is about Spain. Otherwise, it'd be like, okay, great. They're second place. Japan has a long expectancy of life. Spain is number two. And they say over a year, this Reuters photographer interviewed and photographed Spaniards aged 100 or more across the country to just find out what their life is like, why they live so long. The average life expectancy at birth in Spain is 83.2 years, according to the latest statistics. And it's 83.4 in Japan, so 2 month difference. If they want to take that 2 month vacation in Japan, do it earlier rather than later. They say most of the men and women that were interviewed showed, these are people over 100. They showed a zest for life and an interest in pastimes, from amateur dramatics to playing the piano. Many also continued to carry out daily duties, from farm work to caring for a disabled child. So that was what they had in common. They all were active. Had a zest for life. They had hobbies, played piano, worked. They just kept living, and that's why they're still alive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the same with my grandfather. He has a lot of health problems now, but he still has made it to 96 years old, and he had about as active of a younger life as you can imagine on the farm. Even when he left the farm, he was a lumberjack. He was a taxi driver, which you wouldn't think would be too active, but sometimes when those big lumberjacks nearby are getting a little bit belligerent and don't want to pay, you have to deal with it that way too. So a lot of physical activity in his life.
Yeah, I think for some reason there's maybe this idea that if you want to live longer, be healthier, you should not do as much, like take it easy. Yeah. But we're not really built that way. The more we do, usually the more energy we have and the more, you know, strength and so forth. They say that this one guy, Pedro Rodriguez, he's 106. He plays the piano every day. It's wow. Just a something he learned when he was a kid, and he still
incredible.
Plays. 106.
Yeah, I think the key is to keep the mind engaged with something, because the body does go for everyone at some point, and health does deteriorate. But if your mind doesn't, and if you keep it sharp and you're busy with hobbies or taking care of your family, that sort of thing, you have a reason to keep going, and I think that's probably the key. To most of these situations.
Yeah, there's always the examples of people that retire and then they don't really do anything and they don't live long. Or say there's a husband and wife or something and one dies and the other one dies right afterwards. Usually they kind of give up the will to live, sort of. And the other thing that they say that helped these people live was the majority of these elderly people are surrounded by family or had loved ones calling in on them daily. Same in Japan. It's a close-knit society. Families take care of each other more than, say, putting them in nursing homes and things like that, which sometimes maybe you have to do. But that's one of the things, too, that's different about those societies. And people live longer. Surprise, surprise. If somebody comes to see you, you know, maybe there's a reason to get up the next day.
Yeah, it does remind me of an article Jeremiah Jacques wrote about Alzheimer's in America. And there's just an epidemic of it. And not all of it, but some of it is linked to the lack of family interaction with the older generation. And I think that's probably another big component is if the family stays engaged. And I mean, every situation is different. But if you do stay engaged as much as you can, that does help their well-being in a huge way. Probably it's probably the best thing for them.
Yeah, probably so. If you're a lover of Burger King. Oh, by the way, before we get into this, did you have a chance? I know you weren't feeling good the last couple of days, Grant. Did you have a chance to try out the new Starbucks drink for us?
No, but my time's not out. I was actually going to do it today.
Okay, he's going to do it today. So. Sorry, he kind of drifted from the mic there.
Oh, sorry.
It's kind of an issue.
Yeah.
We don't have any secrets here. We tell you what we're doing.
Except for on election night when you said I was sleeping. That was a joke, if everyone was confused about that.
Yeah, and Abraham is knitting a scarf right now.
Wait, what?
No, that's not happening. Yeah, you still have time to try out that tuxedo coffee. And there's
trust me, I was thinking about it this morning. I have not forgotten about that.
Good, because I want a full report. You'll come in with chocolate stains on your face and your shirt. And you'll
couldn't
just
wipe it off.
You'll say, I made a horrible mistake.
I was so sick, I couldn't even move to wipe it off.
It'll be the tuxedo drink in memorial of Grant Turgeon. Couldn't survive. Anyway, Burger King, they are announcing that they're having antibiotic-free chicken in 2017. Yeah, I guess you just don't have to pay for it, but it'll still be in there. No, I'm kidding. They say there won't be any antibiotics in their chicken in 2017. Reason being, the practice of giving antibiotics to farm animals, commercial farmers say, helps promote the animal's growth and keep them free from disease. But, of course, it gets into humans, too. The fear is that superbugs are going to develop, and that will be a ticking time bomb for global health. So we eat a lot of antibiotics.
I didn't even know Burger King served chicken, to be honest.
I thought
chicken fries.
Yeah.
Hey.
That's right. It seems like they should have a Chicken Prince restaurant.
Yeah.
Part of the family. He hasn't ascended to the throne yet. But he's on his way, kind of like Prince Charles. Of course, it looks like he's getting closer to it, too, because his mom's having some hard times with her health. But anyway, completely different subject. But so anyway, this if you do go there and you do eat chicken there, that I guess it'll be better for you. Because it is really quite an issue. They say that 70% of the antibiotics used in this country are used on animals, and then we ingest that. So you're getting antibiotics unless you're really, really careful, and sometimes you don't know.
And those aren't human antibiotics either. They're made for animals, which have completely different physiologies than us. So they're not healthy for us to take anyway. And my father-in-law, he just purchased a couple cows, and they're antibiotic-free. And that's the whole reason he bought them is because in the grocery store, that's only really the only thing you can buy, unless there are some places you can get it. But he got his own cows so he could get the meat from them, and so it's antibiotic-free, and it's a lot healthier.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing what they put in some of those animals. So anyway, if you're thinking about Burger King, now you have a reason. everything else there is bad for you, but the chicken. The chicken will be antibiotic-free, apparently. So, of course, this one's happening. The title is No Horse, No Problem. Girl Teaches Her Pet Cow to Jump. She lives in New Zealand. She wanted to have a horse that she could ride and that would jump. She just didn't have a horse. So she's like, that's fine. I'll just teach my cow to do it.
Teach one of the billions of cows in New Zealand.
Her name is Hannah Simpson. She's a teenager. She rides her Swiss brown dairy cow, Layla, whatever it is, one of those names, on her farm in the country's deep south. She taught the cow to jump because she doesn't have a horse. Well, of course not. She has been doing so since being dared by her brother when the cow was 6 months old, and has now trained her to jump 4.5 feet high. That's a pretty good vertical for a cow.
I do need to ask only one question.
Yeah.
Does the udder need to clear the jump, or is that just everything else?
I don't think they've written the rules for cow jumping yet. I've heard of cow tipping, but I haven't heard of cow jumping. this girl, Hannah Simpson, says, she is a cow, yes, and I can't expect her to ride like a horse. Yes, again. Without a bit of prodding, she wouldn't really do anything. She has a very chilled out nature. Well, she's a cow. I mean, cows don't. They don't do a lot. She says, I've always loved jumping. I always wanted to show jumping on a horse, to do show jumping on a horse. And the cow was always jumping out of the cow shed when she was young, so I think she likes it too. We started her off with stepping over logs, and it just got bigger and bigger. Hannah's Instagram is filled with pictures of herself and the cow jumping logs on the property. It also features pictures of farm life, including other animals like dogs, goats, and sheep. So some young man out there, he just heard that and thought, that's the girl of my dreams.
Sounds like it's a reality show waiting to be made.
The of course, the comments on it, there was only two. Not a real popular story today. And one said, now the cow will jump over the moon. And the other one said the cow was so excited about its fame that it, in celebration, it made a pie. So let that sink in. so I don't know. You know, it's kind of a funny story. I guess you could teach animals to do a lot of things, I guess, if you really put forth the effort. But you know, good on her for just having some ingenuity. You know, you want a horse to jump? Yeah, just get the cow to do it.
It's hard to visualize how she taught it too.
Yeah, and I guess it'd just be persistence.
Yeah. You just jump in front of the cow and hope that the cow mimics you, or
put,
what?
I suppose they would just put something in front of it, I would think, and just kind of pull it. Like, you need to come this way, and then it would have to figure out how to get over the top, I'm assuming. I don't know. I haven't had a lot of experience in training cows to do anything, let alone jump.
Yours sounded like a plausible explanation, though. So clearly,
that could
you have
happen.
A little bit of experience.
I do have about like 35 minutes of experience with a cow. So. Yeah. I had a friend that lived on a dairy farm, and occasionally if I went over to his house, his dad would make me do something, but I'd have to stand out there and look at him and pretend to be helping. But I always thought to myself, I'm glad they don't know how big they are, because it could crush me. But they're not smart.
Yeah, there was I worked for about a year with cows, and so I really don't know anything. But for what I've seen, they can be very wild, energetic beasts, especially if you corner them and you want them to go in a cow pen, to go to a certain place where they won't be cows anymore. They're doing everything possible to get away from you. I've seen them do some amazing physical feats in those circumstances. So I imagine if you put them under enough stress, they'll jump over pretty much anything.
Yeah, I've seen them where they get kind of spooked, and then they're banging into each other and slipping and falling and things like that. And every once in a while you get one that's kind of a little bit sassy, give you a little attitude. He'll you know, push back on you a little bit. So you do have to be careful. They are huge, huge beasts. But anyway, it'd be kind of interesting. You can check out her Instagram account. Her name is Hannah Simpson, and you can look at her cow jumping. If you want to, down there in New Zealand. We have listeners online in New Zealand at kpcg.fm, so maybe she'll tune in one day. We could have an interview with her.
Yeah. In England, they do have, chimpanzees riding on greyhounds, and that was actually a sport in England.
Yeah,
wow. If they can have chimpanzees, I think it was greyhounds or ostriches, it was something crazy. But if you have them, chimpanzees racing on greyhounds, cow jumping's not too... far-fetched.
There was a story years ago about this. You know, sometimes you get two animals and they become friends, and you wouldn't expect it, but they become like long lost buddies. And there was a monkey and a dog that became friends, a little monkey, and the monkey would hold, like, he'd be on the back of the dog and hold them tight, and he just rode around on them all day. And if they pulled the monkey off and put him away, like, you know, further away, he'd run full speed and jump back on. Like, he had to be on the dog, and the dog didn't mind. So maybe he was training, you know, natural rider there.
Seems like a parasitic relationship, though. The dog's not getting too much benefit out of that.
Yeah, he's getting clean, probably.
He's getting a workout, too.
You know, how monkeys always pick, you know, he's probably just cleaning his back all the time.
Well, the monkey has thumbs. He could open gates, get treats for him if they if the situation opens up.
If they combined their
power. The unstoppable robo-dog.
Yeah.
But my cat, sorry, he always wants to come into the house, you know, from the garage at times. And so he tries to push on the door with his head, and he tries to figure out the doorknob, but he can never get it right. And the other day, it didn't latch all the way, and he actually pushed it open and came in. I looked at my wife. I said, now he'll be able to do whatever he wants now that he's figured out the door. We won't be able to restrain anything from him, but he just lucked out on that one. So anyway, kind of interesting story there with animals. Kia David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG. New program this week, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Good time for that show. Yes.
Yes. very, very well-timed silence as well. Yeah, it's, I guess, the Prince of Russia doesn't respond to sanctions.
It doesn't scare him, that's for sure. It says the Bible foretells of an end-time prince of Russia and a messenger who prophesies against this powerful prince. These two men will impact your life directly. Find out who they are. And that's a new program. It's coming up this weekend here on KPCG and also online at kpcg.fm. The videos at thetrumpet.com and on television stations as well. So if you don't want to get up early Sunday and watch it because you're tired, you can watch it online. It's New Year's Eve, right? So people, yes. Some people like to stay up later. And that guy that used to do the New Year's Eve, Dick Clark, he died, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, he did. because he was pretty rough shape for a while, and they but they'd always bring him out for like 2 minutes.
Yeah,
and it was very uncomfortable. So I think he is. Yeah, I think he did die, if I remember correctly. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host Stephen Fleury. That's also coming up here from Edmond, Oklahoma again. Usually over in Edstone, but he's here for a little bit, so live from the studios here. And that program today talks about a few things, including but mainly the U.S. and Israel, their relations, which are just going south very fast. 2016 was the year the wheels came off. All of these ideas about, I guess, after 1989 with the Berlin Wall falling down, this new sort of era of humanity, the fall of the USSR, that's all kind of fallen apart in 2016.
Yeah, I think what's exciting, maybe in the bad way, about 2017 is that it probably will shape the new world order, however that stacks up. And the Bible gives us a pretty clear picture of how it will be. But it is pretty amazing. My parents were in Germany when everything happened there, and they did live through a transition from the Cold War, where everyone kind of walked on eggshells, to post-Cold War, where the world became globalization and liberal economies, free trade. But now we're living through another transition that no one maybe expected to happen. And it's going to shift everything really dramatically.
Yeah, really good. Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure you catch that one and all of the ones from the past week if you missed any. And, you know, when the Berlin Wall fell, from what I've read, Vladimir Putin was in East Germany at the time. And he did not like that. Because, I mean, he, you know, and he has said he felt like the dissolution of the USSR was like the biggest tragedy of the 20th century, I think was his quote. Mm-hmm. And he was there. I mean, he was there in Germany when that occurred, if I remember my history correctly. And they described how he went back to the embassy, I think it was the Russian embassy, and there were people outside, you know, chanting, "Get out of here, Russia," or whatever they were. And he was, you know, he was involved in seeing that. And the thing that bothered him the most, according to the book I read, was that Moscow had no response. Like, he was waiting for them to, like, drop the hammer and sickle. And they didn't do anything, and that really bothered him from what I've read. So you can tell what's on his mind. He does not like the fact that the USSR fell apart. So we see it changing now. And so it's talked about somewhat on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Abe, you've got a story for us here from foreignpolicy.com. Syria will stain Obama's legacy forever. And that's an interesting and pretty bold statement.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about what President Obama's legacy will be when he leaves office, how historians will remember him. But this article does a great job of going through and really taking an honest look at what his legacy will be, and even outside the legacy, that because that's not the most important question, but the world that President Obama leaves behind. What's the world that he leaves behind for us to live in? Because just because he leaves, that doesn't mean all the problems leave with him. And so the big one, of course, is Syria. Syrian civil war has been going on for many years, since 2011. And 400,000 people are dead, about 13 million displaced in the region. And just all kinds of atrocities, chemical weapons, murders, indiscriminate bombings.
They had some really amazing footage from street level there in Syria where they dropped a bomb somewhere. And it's amazing to get that view from the street. Like, there was a small child running and just screaming, and the debris and the dust. And you don't often get like a firsthand look at what that would be like. And so they've had some pretty amazing footage from there. And It's good to see that sometimes, because we hear Syria, you know, forever, kind of like Iraq or whatever, and you just kind of get numb to what's going on. But you look at, like, those are people's lives that are being affected there. It's a really serious situation.
Yeah, and the West hasn't experienced anything like that since the Blitz in 1940, so many, many years ago, and it's almost out of living memory for most of us. And so what he does here is... it's written by David Greenberg, and he does compare President Obama to other presidents who did have atrocities happen while they were in office. You had FDR during the Holocaust, Clinton, while Rwanda and Bosnia happened, and you also have George W. Bush when Darfur was happening in Africa. And in general, people don't necessarily fault the presidents for lack of intervention or for not intervening on the world stage. So maybe people won't remember President Obama as much, but his situation is a little different because by not intervening in Syria, we saw a significant decline in American prestige and power that wasn't associated with Clinton in Somalia or Rwanda or anything like that. America's reputation wasn't on the line. You didn't have world powers start pushing America out of the world picture. But with Syria here, that's what's different, is that the biggest stain on Obama's legacy isn't necessarily all the deaths and the lives of those people, as tragic as that is, and it should be a stain. But the biggest stain is that America is losing their grip on world power, and they allowed Iran and Russia to bully them out of the Middle East and pretty much lose any kind of control over the situation.
Yeah, it's a really good point about like Rwanda or someplace. Terrible events, but again, it could be looked at sort of like a tribal issue. It didn't have a huge impact on the world in general, you know, besides that area. Of course, if you go back and you look at Yugoslavia, that was a huge one with President Clinton, because that had huge implications. We're still feeling the results of that now. That's part of the reason Russia's pushing, because they got upset by that they lost some of their former areas. And but, you know, the other thing, too, is that it's not like we've been completely hands-off. We have, in the last 8 years, we have chosen to do certain things. And the things we've chosen to do have only destabilized pretty much every region that we've touched. And then when we should have intervened, probably we didn't. And I think that's the thing, too. It's not like we didn't do anything. We seem to just do the wrong thing.
Yeah. I think it's a calamity of errors where we chose the wrong kind of solution. And we didn't even, we're not even aggressively seeking to fulfill our goals. Like President Obama, there's many things he has said and done, but he wanted to get rid of Assad. He wants to fight ISIS. Commits very little power, if any, help to Syrian rebels to get rid of Assad. Allows Russia to come in and absolutely crush them to where they have to surrender Aleppo, which was their stronghold. And it looks like Assad will be in power indefinitely. The new ceasefire that just came into being was brokered without the U.S. even having anything to do with it. And so you have these dictators, Assad, Putin, and Khomeini in Iran, basically telling the world what's going to happen in Syria, which is one of the most strategic energy hubs in the world. And it's also a center of violence against our ally Israel. And even it's the source of the migration crisis for Europe as well. So the fact that we barely helped them, that we talked big, but we didn't do anything about it, besides all the humanitarian crisis, is that it's hurting our neighbors, our closest allies, and we're allowing other powers, especially Russia, to come in and tell us what the future is going to be.
Yeah, and it's also exposed the administration for having a completely false value system. Because when the Arab Spring happened, the excuse was like, well, the people have spoken. I mean, it's democracy. We're behind democracy. Well, they protested in Iran, too. And we didn't do a thing about that. And so, you know, it rings pretty hollow after a while. Because America did used to sort of have, I think, like a... Oh, if nothing else, kind of a baseline of like, hey, we do support democracy for better or worse. But we picked and chose in this administration. And like you say, we let the dictators just come in and tell us what to do. You know, Russia's not a democracy. Iran certainly isn't. You know, but we came in and destabilized or allowed the destabilization of Egypt and other places like that. But again, you know, picked and chose. And then, of course, Gaddafi in Libya. And that's a disaster zone now. It's been just bad across the board.
Yeah, and what's more amazing is that President Obama doesn't believe that America should have to keep its word. He doesn't believe that American prestige rests on keeping your commitments, that's just a fallacy. But it's not, and I think the fruits are clear to be shown in the world for that, as you just clearly went down the list of all the regions that are being affected. But I think the biggest thing to consider is that how long will it take to solve these issues? We're not talking about months or even years. It could be even decades before the Middle East can be stabilized. How many years will it take to stop ISIS and terrorism around the world? It's going to take a long time, and the genesis can all be traced back to really the fateful time in Syria when President Obama chose not to do anything.
Yeah, well, I guess the other side of that is that it could potentially be solved immediately by a dictator.
Right.
I mean, they put an end to it. You know, you don't see a lot of problems. You don't see a lot of terror attacks in Russia. I know there's a few. Now, who knows who does them? But it's put down pretty quickly because it's a dictatorship. And I think, Iran will definitely stabilize the region. Isn't that amazing? You don't see a lot of terror attacks in Iran. Isn't that stunning? They must have great security there. It's because they're the ones that do it all. And they tried. They had that one the other, I remember a couple of months ago or whatever. But I don't think it was a real one. I don't know what the deal was, but I don't know if they were just trying to get people off their trail or something, but in any event. So, a lot of problems there. But I guess the only thing I would think about this article about Syria staining that legacy, get in line. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Isn't there like a whole list of things? Syria's one, but there's a lot. It's not just Syria.
Yeah, there's a huge laundry list of failed policies, domestic, international.
The Iran deal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing he goes over, is that it's going to be very difficult to try to figure out exactly what President Obama was trying to do. If you just look at his actions and have certain assumptions, because it's perplexing him helping an ally then helping the enemy of the ally, and what he's actually been, what's the goal of his vision in the Middle East, where he's completely failed at everything he set out to do in his inauguration speech: be friends with the Arab world, solve the peace process between Israel and Palestine. He's failed at doing all those things, and that's just the Middle East. We're not even talking about the rest of the world.
But then tells us that everything's great and everything is better in every single way since he came into office.
Yeah.
Have to wait for the memoirs. Have to wait for the library to be opened up and find out what really happened. So anyway, really interesting write-up there at foreignpolicy.com. And, of course, another part of this legacy is what's going on over there in the Middle East. Grant, you have an article here from the Los Angeles Times. With the two-state solution a distant dream, Palestinians ask if it's time to push for a one-state solution. What's a one-state solution? Just Palestinians and get rid of everybody else?
Well, that's the funny part, is I never realized that the Palestinians legitimately hope for two states side by side, one Jewish and one Arab, in the first place. I believe they've always been saying that they want to eliminate the Jews from Jordan to the Dead Sea. So I guess maybe they have apparently changed that. Or Jordan to the Mediterranean? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they have not. They've never said they want peace, other than when they kind of have to do it to forward their terrorist agenda and take something and get something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, peace, give me something. And then, then we continue our fight. So what do they mean when they say one state solution? They're all just going to live together and get along? Is that their dream, or what? Is it different than that?
Basically, and the issue here is that it would be like a demographic Trojan horse, where they basically try to outbreed the Jews until they are the majority in the region. And if they can somehow obtain full voting rights and be able to vote in their own politicians, you could imagine it's going to get pretty bad there for the Jews pretty fast.
Yeah, I think people would vote on party line. I mean, it would be that would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. You just even think. I mean, that's kind of what it is now, except they don't have all those rights. But I mean, they are mixed together a little bit there. And every time they are, every area where they're mixed together is just disaster after disaster. And it's always coming from the Palestinian side,
mm-hmm.
whether it be stabbing people, whether it be bus bombs, whether it be a bulldozer, whether it be, you know, whatever they can get their hands on, they're always causing the attacks. You know, if you just take a step back and say, what's the last terror attack that Israel caused? Has there ever been one?
Back in the 1940s when they were fighting Great Britain. But they weren't fighting Arabs, they were fighting Britain for their independence.
Okay.
And that was some extreme Jewish groups. That wasn't even
right.
That wasn't Ben Gurion and the main government. That was just some extremist groups.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's. I thought we were talking about Mr. Netanyahu yesterday. I believe one of his comments when he was talking about, I guess his comments back towards the U.S. after all of the U.S.'s comments. And he said, well, I forget what he said the heart of the problem was, but he really got down to it. I had it in my mind and it escaped me. But basically the fact that they just don't want the Jews there, that's the whole issue. That's the heart of the issue. It's not anything else. It's not settlements. It's not anything like that. It's just they don't want the Jews there.
That's exactly right. And that's why I found this article bordering on comical, because it was so biased. Even the headline gives away that it's biased. The fact that after all these years, they're finally seeking a one-state solution. That gives the impression that they have ever sought a two-state solution in the first place. It says further down that Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has staked his political career on a nonviolent campaign to negotiate for a Palestinian state and has given no signs that he's about to change. Did you know he was a nonviolent leader?
I was not aware of that. That is news
that he
to
has
me.
Not ever been in support of terrorist attacks or doing whatever it takes to exterminate the Jews.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
Apparently so.
Learning things here on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
I did see a political cartoon just to back that up, and it's a picture of Abbas on one side of a table, Netanyahu and another, and John Kerry behind Abbas. And Abbas is, it's actually Hamas, not Abbas, sorry. Hamas, a terrorist group. They hold up a sheet of paper that says, kill all the Jews. And Kerry's behind him saying, well, can't you meet him halfway? And that says what he's asking him to do.
Yeah. Well, there's Stephen Fleury on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. He talked about this political cartoon he saw where you have, you know, I forget if it was, if some representation of Israel, I don't know how they did it, with a snake wrapped around the neck. And I think it was John Kerry saying, well, you know, can you see it from their point of view? Like the snake's point of view. Something maybe I didn't get that quite right, but I think that's what it was. And so sometimes you get more truth than anything in those political cartoons, because that's what it is.
That's spot on what it is. That's exactly the problem going on here. Speaking of John Kerry, in that speech, he warned of the risk on Wednesday of a fundamental reality for the two sides to consider. If the choice is one state, Israel can either be Jewish or democratic. It cannot be both, and it won't ever really be at peace. So he's saying that somehow if you mix the Jews and the Arabs evenly amongst each other, that it's going to be more peaceful than having them separate for the most part.
Yeah.
So Jewish or democratic, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, by far, they're the most, you could call them democratic in the entire region, by far.
So does he want the Jewish race to cease to exist? Is that what he's hoping for? Like they'll just intermingle so much that there won't be a Jewish race anymore?
He doesn't want it to be a Jewish state. He doesn't want Israel to be defined as a Jewish state.
Yeah. I mean, I, in a sense, I get like the whole, I guess he could look at America and say, well, we're all Americans, even though we're different, you know, people. I get what he's going at there. But really, at the heart of it, you know, what's wrong with saying, no, I am Jewish. I'm proud of that. That's fine. You know, and we need our own space. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's there's plenty, like has been pointed out tons of times. There's a lot of space. You can move around over there. I mean, you don't have to be right there.
Right. Well, at the heart of the controversy, there's five demands the Palestinians have, I believe, that's in the peace process.
Six of them being to just exterminate the Jews?
Yes. Okay. One of them is called a right of return, which is that all refugees from 1948 until now, all the families who were forced to leave Palestinian territory, quote-unquote, to other Arab nations who live in refugees, so we're talking about millions and millions of people, that if there is a one state or a two state, they have to have the right to return, be paid compensation for their losses, and they have all the rights to vote. The reason Israel will never agree to that is because of what's already been mentioned. If you have millions of Arabs return and outnumber the Jews, they can elect in whoever they want. And that's very dangerous for the Jewish people. And that's why Israel will never agree to that. And they say, well, why can't you just live in all these other Arab nations? And why do you have to live just in our land where we have a legal state?
Yeah, it's they have to fight for their survival, unlike probably almost anybody else. And they've had to do that multiple times through the last, you know, living memory with obviously World War II and so forth. So, it's just an upside down world, where somehow they're they're the aggressor now, even though they're just trying to defend their existence.
Yeah, and the funny part, too, if you could call it that, is that so many of the Palestinians who abandoned that territory in the first place did it because they thought that Israel was going to be wiped out by those Arabs in those two wars. And so they left. They were assured that the Arabs would win and that they could return with all the Jews gone and live in that area again. And then when that didn't happen, of course, the Jews aren't going to let them just waltz right back in there when clearly they showed where their allegiance truly lied.
Yeah, and I mean, it's war. You know, hey, we won. It's our land now. That's the way it goes.
And we just they just have to let their enemies walk right in among them again.
Yeah, and I mean, and Israel really has gone above and beyond to try to, you know, even to the point of it being like a wound, as is written about in quite a few write-ups at thetrumpet.com. But anyway, they have done their part. I mean, there's so many books even out there about how they tried to just keep the Palestinian attacks at bay, and they could easily just take care of them, but they don't, and they drop leaflets saying, we're going to bomb this area, please evacuate, because it's a terror, you know, area with weapons and so forth. And the Palestinians on the other side are just barbaric. They'll throw their own children into the mix to just make Israel look bad, you know, throw them there, or put weapons under a grade school, which has been documented that's happened. And the world just looks at it and completely the wrong way. It's you couldn't explain it to somebody if you weren't living through it to see it.
And those child victims you're talking about, in a lot of cases, are in agreement with the cause. They're raised from a young age on cartoons that show Jews as evil and they must be exterminated. And then, of course, by the time they're even 6, 7, 8 years old, they're throwing rocks at the Jews because they just hate them so much.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing what's happening. That's a write-up from the LA Times with a two-state solution, a distant dream. Palestinians ask if it's time to push for a one-state solution. So kind of interesting to see what's going on there. That's all the time we have today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us here. Hopefully you have a great weekend. And 2016 coming to an end. What's ahead for 2017? We don't know. We'll find out. We'll see you next week. For myself, Dwight Folk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, thanks for joining us here on 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.